Support for ThinkBook Radio comes from listeners like you. Consider helping to make independent productions like ThinkBook Radio possible by becoming a donor. Your generous gift helps to keep these unique voices broadcasting and exploring. Details about how you can help can be found at thethinkbook.com/donate. Thanks.
You are listening to Always Record from ThinkBook Radio and thethinkbook.com. Today, for episode 103 of Always Record, Jason Horsley with Mark LeClaire.
Hi.
Hello, hello. So do we have, can I just hear Mark for a second? Mark, are you there?
I am here.
And Jason Horsley, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm right here.
Wonderful. So just to clarify, I know you have a series of monikers. Is there something, a name you want to use for today's show?
Are you Jason Horsley today? Yeah, I'm keeping to the one now. I'm finally settling down into a single identity. So it's Jason with a U and Horsley, just regular. No I's, no Horace, just Horsley.
Okay, you got it.
I realized something. Obviously, we're going to stick to the original plan, which is we're going to give Jason the first hour to lay out his current theory, his current Kubrick theory, before we bring in extra commentary from Mark et al. But I want to sort of throw something out here at the beginning. You both are in the ThinkBook Volume 2 together. I don't know if you know of each other's work before all this, or if this is a recent sort of realization that you're both on a similar sort of tip, but it occurred to me that Jason has changed his name to Ja Sun, S-U-N, right? You're going with this very solar sun, Jason Horsley, you're the sun figure. Mark LeClaire has sort of taken on his identity based off that essay he wrote for ThinkBook 2, Moon in the Middle. So I feel like there's a really interesting alchemical thing happening here where we're bringing the sun and moon together today. It's just one of the many reasons I'm excited to have you both.
Gotcha.
It's real for me too.
May I ask before we get started, so again, I know, Jason, you were familiar with Kotze's work and stuff like that, so you were familiar with Sinkhole and Synchromysticism, and Mark way back was a writer even for the Sinkhole. How familiar are you each other with each other's work?
I found out about Mark when he commented at my blog, and then I followed that to the talks he's done with you, and so it was quite recent for me, like a few months.
And Mark?
Well, I bought a book written by Mr. Eolus Kafas, called The Lucid View. I bought that in a chapter. I was just looking for the weirdest possible book I could find. This was almost 10 years ago. And I had it in the house for a few years, and I flipped through it many, many times and read it. And that was my, of course, I had no idea who Mr. Horsley was at that time. Later on, I learned about him in a discussion with you, Alan, where we were arguing. And just to add a little bit to that alchemical idea, you and I were arguing about whether or not it would be Horsley or myself who wrote an article for the ThinkBook 2. I wasn't really, as you know, you had to do a great deal of coaxing to get me to do it. And I was thinking, if he's going to do it, then I don't have to. So the idea of our relationship in that book is more than just the fact that we're kind of a sun and a moon. So, yeah, and that's the second time I was aware. And that was when you told me who he was. You mentioned the name Eolus Kafas to me, Alan. And that was the moment when I knew who you were talking about. And then since then, I've looked read a couple of your articles. I read your article on The Counselor. And I read your article on The Master. And I've read a couple of other of your just kind of general pieces. So that's kind of where we're at.
And Jason, is your main website now is Audiculture?
Yeah.
Okay. So there is a series of articles you've been doing there, plus a podcast you did with Doug Lane.
I listened to the podcast as well, just for the record.
And that's maybe sort of... I think is a very large impetus behind today's talk. So I'm going to ask if everyone sort of get comfy and cozy here and kind of settle in. Maybe we'll ask Mark and myself and David to kind of mute, and Jason, you can kind of start dropping what you wanted to drop on us here today based out of those articles and that podcast.
Okay, that sounds reasonable. Puts a lot of pressure on me, but I can think I can handle it. So that's it, huh? You muted. Wow. Okay.
this is a conversational space, so we can always unmute. But I wanted to try to keep to our promise here. So
yeah, no, it's good. It's very helpful. I appreciate it. Because I mean, part of the reason I asked this is that I'm in the midst of the process. Like, it's not as though I've been working on this like many of you guys for years, and I've got it all kind of mapped out, and this is just in the last few weeks and even the last few days and in the last few hours that stuff is coming. So it's really like an alchemical hot pot, my psyche. And as some of you probably know, I was never into Kubrick. My interest and now borderline obsession with Kubrick began because I couldn't get it. I couldn't get why so many people were so obsessed with him. And it really bugged me. I always felt that he was the most overrated artist in history. And I had a kind of mission to make people see that. I wouldn't say it was a mission. That's definitely overstating it. But whenever it came up, that would be my main focus, was to try and make people see that the emperor had no clothes. So yeah, but a lot of stuff's been coming up, and I've written this piece, or I'm still in process of writing it. I just emailed you and Mark some bullet points. I got 20 points that I mapped out in preparation for this chat. I don't think that there's any way we'll get to all 20, but that's okay. I just would like to have some structure to this. I'll tell you why. For me, like, my interest in Kubrick is not so much in Kubrick or even the Kubrick's films, but those who have become obsessed with him and his films. And that would be you guys. So not only, of course, there's many more of you, but I think you more or less fit the bill. Feel free to object if you don't want to be identified that way, but that's my impression anyway. And so for me, this is kind of like field work. Like, this is me going into the Overlook Hotel, into the labyrinth of the Minotaur for the first time. And coincidentally, I just finally got The Shining. Like, The Shining is a film that I have never liked. I've always wanted to like. I've tried to like it. I have friends that I respect who love it. And it bugged the hell out of me. And I watched it recently after my conversation with Doug Lane, in which I dissed The Shining and emphasized one of my bullet points, which is that the film is deliberately bad. And after that, I watched the film, and I was trying so hard not to like it. Whereas in the past, I'd been trying hard to like it. And in both cases, I failed. In the past, I tried to like it, and I failed. And this time, I tried not to like it, and I failed. And so that's a perceptual shift for me.
Just to verify, you're saying your failure was you were trying not to like it and you couldn't help but like it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
For the first time, I found myself actually liking the movie. So yeah, it's like I've been... I've been drawn into the labyrinth, and I'm seeing it from the inside now. So I hope nobody will take this the wrong way, but for me, coming on this podcast is a little bit like going into the Overlook Hotel and willingly submitting to the phantasms and the projections and the borderline madness of the Kubrick obsession, of the Kubricon, as I call it. So that's partly why I felt like I should be very Kubrick-like about this and very structured and have all my numbered bullet points and everything. And last night I dreamt, and this is a very good indication for a writer that his unconscious is engaged. I dreamt about being in the Overlook on the set of The Shining with Kubrick. He'd invited me there, and he was answering questions for me, and he was confirming certain neuro-linguistic programming elements in the movie. And in fact, they were elements that went on the screen. They were there for the characters to see, but we couldn't see them because they weren't in the shot. They were actually behind Jack Nicholson when he's doing the interview on the door, for example, and stuff like this. And so this was kind of, and I was thinking in the dream, I was thinking, my God, how could I have left this out of my essay, my piece? It's actually going to be a book at this point. The fact that Kubrick, I actually knew Kubrick, and I was, you know, discussing with him the movie, even as I'm writing this piece. I've got to include that in the piece. It was crazy oversight. Then when I woke up, I obviously realized why I hadn't put in the piece, because it hadn't happened until that point. I don't think this was astral contact with Kubrick or anything necessarily, but it did make me want to mention right out the gate, and this isn't one of my bullet points, that for me, the purpose of existence is for sentience to meet sentience, for soul connections to occur. And so it occurred to me that the only really meaningful goal or end point of all of this Kubrick, whatever you want to call it, Kubrickophilia or Kubrick analysis, or is to connect to Kubrick. And so, like on the last, I think it was the last one that Mark was on, you were talking about this other guy, I don't know who it was, who likes to see himself as Kubrick's equal and imagines himself as being meeting up with Kubrick and being recognized as his greatest fan and all that. And I thought that was very funny and very interesting, very pertinent to a kind of a quality or an element of this Kubrick obsession, which is the desire actually to be on a level with Kubrick and to be recognized by him. It's, you could say it's a kind of father thing, very deep father thing. But anyway, after my dream, it occurred to me this, that actually that is the real goal, is to connect with Kubrick as an equal. And, well, we do have an edge on Kubrick. Like, so many people are in awe of him and enthralled to him, but it occurred to me that we here now have a major edge on Kubrick, and that is that we're alive and he's not. Well, as far as we know, of course, he may have faked that death anyway, in which case he'll be listening to this at some point. But anyway, that is just a preamble. That's an intro. So I haven't even got to my points, but I'm going to just turn it over to you because I don't want to feel like I'm just giving a lecture here. So anyway, yeah, pause for breath.
David, do you want to sort of step in here?
I'm having many different thoughts, as I'm sure everyone else is.
Sure, yeah.
There's a distinction being made between artist and scientist. I think you could also make the same distinction, and there's many other titles that would fit the bill besides scientist in terms of qualifying the nature of his work. I would say alchemist. I would say Kabbalist. I guess alchemist is science of Egypt, but yeah, you get the idea. But basically, I don't know. I look at it and I see him taking a much older, much, much older art form and applying it to what is considered a new art form that has been removed from its roots. There's a type of expressionism that's very imagery based, where as much, if not more, is being communicated with the images themselves as with the story. The story actually takes on, in general, most Kubrick films, especially the later ones, takes on less of a significant, oftentimes, than the hieroglyphic nature of what's being communicated with the imagery. And so people who are attuned in that way. I mean, you know, in terms of language, in terms of communication, if you can receive a communication on another level, other than kind of the superficial contextual level that we usually approach things. I think what I gather from it is that one of its chief aims is to encourage different types of development of taking in information than the ones that are generally prescribed. And so in that sense, it's like subversively revolutionary, because I don't even think that that's as plain to recognize for most. It's like, what am I watching? But there's all these other things happening, you know, and there's plenty of clues that are there that back that up. I mean, so many things that I've mentioned on the show, Carl Jung's Red Book on Ullman's desk is a big one for me. References that he's made, his inspirations. He's talked about how much The Golden Bough meant to him by Fraser, which is huge. Like really meant something to him, like he was obsessed with it. Mark has pointed out to me his obsession with Pinocchio, which at first I didn't scoff at, but I didn't take it ultimately that seriously until I stopped for a while and gave it more thought, and then I'm like, holy shit, you're totally right. That is a straight up obsession with Pinocchio. You know, his reference to Freud's The Uncanny as an inspiration, and the implications of that when you look at what that analysis is about. A lot of things. But I think that there's something to be said for Kubrick fans wanting to achieve, equal status with the person who they are trying to decipher and understand what it is that's being communicated. I feel like that is ultimately... for me, that feels beside the point. It's kind of like there's this, like with anything, where there's that tendency towards you want to feel connected with whoever it is that inspires you. And if you're reading a book of somebody, you know, I was like, you know, I could be reading somebody and feeling that same kind of pull to want for, you know, equal status. But I don't think that that's... I don't know. Maybe there's more significance to that than I'm realizing. But about that side of it for me, I'm like, I could be on a whole. I could be taking something completely removed from what Kubrick intended, and yet at the same time, I feel like there's value in that as well, because I go down my own. I come to my own understandings, and it just becomes a instrument to aid me in that process. So, does this make sense to you?
Well, it brings to mind this, what I'm forever falling back on now, is the McLuhan thing, the medium is the message. And when you talked about the brain, reading a book and how you might want to connect to the author, I would counter that you are connecting to the author, whether you like it or not. And that this is interesting because Stephen King, you know, Kubrick's nemesis, wrote about this in his book on writing. And he described how writing is a form of telepathy. He didn't get into mirror neurons or anything, which I wrote about a while back at Reality Sandwich. That what communicates through writing, and I would say any kind of communication, any kind of art or messaging, is not just what we're consciously receiving, but also the brain state of the individual or the individuals who created that message at the time they created it. It's kind of embedded as this zip file of encoded information in the surface message. So when we read a book, we're not just thinking these thoughts, these words are not just running through our head in the present, but in some subtle energetic way, we're tuning into the brain state of the individual, the individuals who created that at the time they did.
Right, but so, you see the irony with that, with Kubrick, is that, you know, you look at The Shining, and that's the only film that was ever produced of a Stephen King book that Stephen King has, like, publicly come out and, you know, has acknowledged how much he hated it. It's the only one he hated. It's because it's so far removed from what he was communicating, and that's because Kubrick took his own thing from what was written and decided to make a movie about his relationship to like his interpretation of the book, which is completely not what King intended at all. And so for us to do that with the film is just another level to the same principle. You see what I'm saying?
Except that maybe, unlike King, Kubrick actually wants us to do that, I would
and
say.
That's, that, let's go in that direction, because I listened to your Douglas Lane podcast. You talk about this idea that Kubrick is presenting specifically a puzzle, that his films are at least the context that he presents them in. If medium is the message, the medium in this case is not just the medium of film, but the medium of puzzle. Right, he's handing you a maze, something to figure out, and then you say this in one sense is the allure of the movies. It's also just like any maze or quote unquote labyrinth in the non-traditional sense, you can get trapped in it. Right, so we tell this idea of the invitation. David is relating to this as a puzzle that is for transformative purposes, and I get the impression, that you see it in very much the opposite way. I want to hand it back to you, but just throw in one other twist to this. We have a different director, David Lynch, who is, so I don't want to confuse the subject, but to say he's someone who actively advocates for transcendental meditation and peace and all these very high enlightenment sort of ideas, but his films are clearly the opposite. They are the absolute drudgery of human horrible, the horrors that the human race can achieve, and there's this seeming dichotomy there. I just want to throw that into the mix, because is the author of any art, piece of art, are they, yes, they are, it's a sense of telepathy of giving you their mental state, but can someone with a quote-unquote high ideal mind also see the horrors for what they are and present that, if that makes sense? So I want to hand it back to you, just throwing that into the mix.
Okay, yeah, I'll not get sidetracked by Lynch, because it would be a sidetrack. I know that Lynch admired Kubrick, so I think that there is some connection there that's worth exploring, but I'm going to bring it back to my bullet points, and because it is relevant here, and I feel very anal now, but point number five I think relates to this, which is Kubrick's films are impersonal. I'm reading myself now. They do not show the workings out of a personal obsession, as the work of all other great artists show, and that would be Lynch. So I would say Lynch is working out these persons. Not always. I think there's good Lynch and there's bad Lynch, but with Blue Velvet, he was clearly working out a personal obsession, and the transcendence is through the darkness. It's not out of or away from. He's going through it to the other side. But with Kubrick, there's never the feeling for me that he's working out or wrestling with his own demons. But as I point out, that they're obviously not hack jobs. He's obviously not just taking the work and you know, doing it to get the money. They're ultra personal in terms of the choices of the material and the Kubrick's commitment to it, right? So tying that in with my second point, well, the first point and the second point, which is I'm my kind of position on Kubrick now, which has modified since I spoke with Doug Lane and since I watched The Shining. Where initially, yeah, I was seeing Kubrick's intentions, or at least his results, as the opposite of transformative, as somehow negative, and I was seeing him as a kind of satanic, nihilistic figure. I now see him more in a more neutral terms as scientific. So my feeling about Kubrick is that he's not an artist, that he's a scientist, and these are very different things. To back that up, it occurred to me recently, I was watching Kubrick Life in Pictures for the second time, and just looking at his early films, thinking about his early films, that it occurred to me that it's possible that Kubrick approached filmmaking from the very beginning as a scientist, and that to begin with, like all his films leading up to but not including 2001, could be seen as individual experiments. That each time he made a film, he was conducting an experiment. So say with The Killing, he wanted to make, it was very early in his career, so he basically wanted to make a crime film, a heist film, to experiment with the form, just as many filmmakers do. So it was still on the level of, you know, cinematic experimentation, which is nothing particularly unusual. Then with Paths of Glory, he wanted to make an anti-war film and experiment with that. Like, how far could he push the point and expose the hypocrisy of the war industry and the politics of war and get away with it? And I would say the result of his experiment was successful. He was banned in France. So we're talking about real-world effects of films, which I think is the key to Kubrick. He wasn't interested in art. He was interested in actually affecting the world at a social level. But not for its own sake, not because he was an activist, but because he was experimenting. He wanted to experiment on society and human consciousness. Then after that was, I believe, Spartacus. That was his experiment. Can I do a Hollywood blockbuster? Can I be a Hollywood filmmaker? So that was a bit more of a conventional experiment, like, but also as a way to get power, and maybe you could say that was a more of a cynical move. So there may be something else in Spartacus that I haven't thought about. Then with Lolita, he took on basically the most controversial subject then and now that there is, paedophilia. And again, the experiment had real world results. It was, you know, the Catholic League of Decency. I don't know if they actually banned it or what the actual effects of them rising up against it. They made him edit it. Okay, so
yeah, they took out certain scenes, yeah, a certain part.
Yeah, so not as major an effect as Paths of Glory, but still, he got a reaction. He got a real world response from the Vatican, no less. Then after that was Dr. Strangelove. Obviously that was a major experiment because he was taking on the most serious subject imaginable, which was the destruction of the human race, and turning it into a comedy. So, and he began as to treat the material seriously, and then he said, oh, you can't treat this seriously, they're insane. That was his story for why he did it. I would say there was more to it than that. It was, again, like, can I actually take subject matter that by all rights is just horrific and horrifying and incomprehensibly dark and make something funny and light and ironic out of it? Whether, here we're getting into more controversial areas, like whether, as Pauline Kael argued, the subtitle, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, was not ironic, was actually a statement of intent, and the film was designed to create a kind of placid acceptance, an ironic distance from the reality that I don't know, you can only speculate about that, but certainly it did have.
Do you realize that Dr. Strangelove was originally not intended to be a comedy at all?
Yeah.
He was very serious about it, and he, I forget how many books on nuclear shit he read, but he read many before the making of the film. And it was actually when they started filming it, they couldn't stop fucking laughing. Mm-hmm. And then, this is the story, at least this is a cover story. And then they ended up embracing it as a comedy because very quickly they realized how satirical it could be and how much better it would be as a comedy. And so that's a little interesting to that argument, but worth mentioning, I guess.
Earlier this morning, I was having a conversation about the rise of the comedic journalist. You know, we had Daily Show, then the Colbert Report, and now John Oliver, is it? This idea that, you know, it's a very old idea. If you want to tell someone the truth, you have to make them laugh. And I'm not proposing that John Stewart et al. Have the truth, but you get what I'm saying, that if we want to expose something, it's much easier to do it with a smile. This is why a George Carlin or a Bill Hicks is so popular for people who want to think a little deeper into things. So there's this idea. Even like one of my favorite writers is Kurt Vonnegut, who he's constantly talking about the most horrific things in this black humor sort of way. And very often it's a way to touch a truth, even a Mark Twain, if you will, right? To touch a truth that otherwise it would just be bleak and beating you over the head. But if you can do it with a wink and a smile, it's sort of it's the honey, not vinegar approach. Again, I don't know if that's Kubrick's intent here, but I could certainly be open to that argument. At the risk of going off on a tangent, I just have to ask, I've asked nearly everyone, I think, this question, and I have to ask it to you, Jason, while we're on the subject of Strangelove. The plot point in there of making, Ripper so, quote-unquote, crazy. He's clearly not a reliable source of information, right? He's obsessed with bodily fluids, etc., etc. But the fact that he sees the communists as putting fluoride in the water, right? That this is a pretty integral part of the story, and he is made out to be ridiculous. Then we have, if you go online today, nearly every truth-seeking, whatever category or label we want to put on to this modern alternative research movement, nearly everyone would say fluoride is really, really, really bad, and it's part of a conspiracy in one form or another. What is your take on that plot point? Again, I know you don't completely speculate. I'm just curious, how do you see that? Is that a making fun of the truth? Is that sneaking in truth? Or is it that he thought it was ridiculous? Or any combination of those?
I think it's too difficult to even speculate on that because there were several writers on Strangelove. I mean, there was at least two anyway, main ones, Terry Southern and Kubrick. So, I wouldn't even try and speculate about that. I think, you know, the question of how serious Dr. Strangelove is valid. You know, how much is it mocking and just kind of ironically indifferent to the realities it's presenting, and how much is it sincerely trying to expose something? It is a very, I think, central question, like to try and understand Kubrick and what his intentions were. But I mean, good luck with that, because I've kind of tried to stay away from that because I think it's impossible in the end to fathom somebody's intentions. I will say in a more general way that when I'm making some of these points, often I'll be making them in a quite a broad way as a sort of counterpoint. But I don't see anything as generally as either one thing or another. So when you talk about Kubrick making Strangelove and them laughing their asses off and that it was kind of organic, possibly the choice to make it a comedy, I think that could also be true, that it's not either that he calculated this as this chess move to see what the opponent would do, as in society or the audience, or it was organic. It can definitely be both, because the psyche is so many faceted, but it's shades of one bleeding into the other.
Sure, even if it is trying to make people, that again, that old adage of if you want to tell people the truth, you have to make them laugh, that is in a form a manipulation or a strategic move, even if it's a benign intention. And again, I'm not here to make Kubrick out to be a saint by any stretch of the imagination, but to say, even if we want to say it wasn't a nefarious decision, it is of that same strategic, or how you put it, scientific mind. David has pointed out that for The Shining, Kubrick studied, and what's this to you, David? Pointed that Kubrick studied subliminal advertising, like how advertisers can get certain reactions out of people, and that this was something he incorporated of how to impart a sense of terror into people. These little things where a chair is moved so subtly, or these little incongruities in the film that might just continuously, subtly upset the psyche, that something's off, and you can't quite place what it is, but something's off, and that was a very strategic psychological move, is something that's been talked about a lot, and that you could certainly see that as nefarious, but even again, taking the good, quote unquote good or quote unquote bad off it, I agree with your sense of something almost scientific of saying how, you know, we could take some of the theory out of it.
Well, it's interesting in that point about the chairs and the shining moving, because that's a very sophisticated way of creating unease in the audience, and that's perfectly valid for somebody making a horror film to do stuff like that. You don't have to posit any kind of agenda besides creating effects in a horror movie. But if you, in a very subtle way, but if you juxtapose that with other effects in The Shining, which in my opinion are really, what word can I use? They're very broad. They're actually kind of cheesy. They're not, they're the kind of effects that are very inept, a very poor horror film maker would use, like the blood gushing out of the elevator, for example, and particularly right at the beginning of the movie, before we even know what the fuck it means or why it's there. It's a very odd device. It's the kind of like hit the audience on the head with big grand guignol imagery so that they're all unsettled and they know that they're going to be scared. It's like what a hack horror filmmaker would do, right? And there's a lot of that in The Shining, like the way that music is and the acting. In many ways, the whole film is very overwrought. And as a horror film, I would say very unsubtle, the opposite of subtle. But at the same time, congruent or coexisting with that, there's these incredibly subtle touches. So it does suggest that there are two, Kubrick has two agendas going, at least two, I would say. But the two obvious agendas, one was to make a horror movie, and the other was this unknown thing, to make something else that we're all here trying to actually figure out what it was. And I would say that the point isn't to figure out what it was. The point is to try. That was what Kubrick wanted. I don't think he created a... There is a second movie in The Shining. Like, there's two movies. There's one superimposed on the other, which is why that person who's played it forward and backwards, that was a stroke of genius, I think. I haven't seen the results, but...
That's John Felrine. He's been on the show a few times, yeah.
Oh, right. He's on Facebook. I didn't realize that was that guy. So he's the guy who's in Room 237.
Correct. Sure, yeah, he's in that as well.
Right. That's a really nice kind of literalization of what The Shining is. It's like two movies, one superimposed on the other. So you've got on the surface is this very poor adaptation of Stephen King's novel, and poor in the sense of unfaithful, but also in certain ways like not a very good horror movie, I would say. And then under that you have this other movie, and it's... So you can find that other movie, but as Room 237 indicates, it's not fixed. It's a subjective artifact. It actually changes according to the observer who's observing it. And so then what that second movie is not a movie at all, and the content of it that we find there is actually, in a sense, irrelevant. It doesn't matter if it's about the moon landing or the Holocaust, or except so far as if we're finding that, that's significant to us. So, of course, it's going to be meaningful to us. But in a larger scale of things, what's meaningful is that Kubrick has what he's created as a way to capture our attention, that phenomenon itself. How he did it is interesting, of course, but to me what's most interesting of all is why. Like, what's the end game here?
So can we speak a little to that? You said that it's still a sort of coming together. I'm not trying to pigeonhole you into a certain stance, but you said at some point you thought it was something nefarious, satanic. You're opened you're not necessarily sure of that anymore, but do you have a sense of the why?
I do. I think is the answer, but well, first of all, if I were just to blurt it out, and I don't want this to come off as being coy, really, but it wouldn't be very convincing, because I would need to kind of show you the process by which I arrived at it. It may just be one aspect of it. The main thing that, I mean, the overarching conclusion, if that's the right word or sense I've got, is, I've already said, is that Kubrick was performing an experiment, a sociological experiment, and that the early films were individual experiments. But then, as beginning with 2001, that was both an experiment unto itself, and we could go into, you know, the counterculture and LSD, MK Ultra, all that stuff if we want. Probably best not to, but there's plenty of room for theorizing about how that was a sociological experiment, a psyop, as it's popularly known now, but that it was also the beginning of the second phase of the Kubrickon, which was his entire oeuvre then became one great big experiment. From 2001 to Eyes Wide Shut was the capstone. I think AI, Jay Widener may be right, AI was supposed to be the capstone, but whatever, it didn't happen. So that was phase two. And then phase three, I would say, is underway now. Now that Kubrick has gone, we just have the works, and we are phase three, what we're doing now. I haven't said enough already, or too much.
Well, we could keep going with this to kind of prod you for more. I just want to say, if you said to state your point without fully getting there, wouldn't do it justice. We have asked Mark Acquare to hold back for the first hour and just listen in. According to my clock here, you have about 23 minutes left. So I want to just sort of make you aware of that. And if there's something you really want that you think is foundational for the wider conversation.
Fair enough, yeah. Well, I'll go back to the bullet points then. The thing about cognitive dissonance, I don't think any discussion of Kubrick is, not just that it's not complete, but it's kind of meaningless if it doesn't mention cognitive dissonance. I think that this is a key to Kubrick. It has been touched on even in this conversation today, and things that Alan and Dave have said. There are ways in which it's obviously creating cognitive dissonance, such as, you know, little trivial ways like the disappearing chair and whatnot. But the thing that I brought up with Doug Lane when I was still more entrenched in my anti-Kubrick position was that a deeper or a wider or a more kind of meta level of the cognitive dissonance is that Kubrick films, in my view, and I still feel this way even after seeing The Shining, Kubrick's later films are deliberately bad in a certain way. There are elements in them that are actually not meant to work dramatically. But this is only one side of the cognitive dissonant strategy. The other necessary element is that Kubrick, during the first phase of his career up to and culminating with 2001, Kubrick's aim, one of his aims, was to create an aura around himself and his name of greatness, of sainthood almost, that he to establish himself as the greatest filmmaker of all time. Now, you could say that was just cynical. It was just not, I mean, if it were true, I'm sure that people would object to that in itself. But I'm not saying that he did that out of vanity or ego. I'm sure that was part of it. But I think that there was a more far-reaching aim, which was to, again, this experiment, that if he could embed the culture with the idea that he was a genius and a great filmmaker, and then from that position, once that was established, make films that in certain ways were just plain bad, and get people to still, well, I won't say still see them as works of genius, because that's not necessarily the point, but they would wrestle with them. They go to see this movie, and they know that Kubrick is a genius, and they expect greatness, and then they're crushed with disappointment when they see the movie. This happened with The Shining. This happened with Eyes Wide Shut. Obviously, that was really the coup de grace, because nobody could say that was a good film, really, at the time. I don't think now they can, but really, and I know I don't want to be objectionable here, but my experience of it was just gobsmacking awe at how awful it was. Full Metal Jacket, people don't talk about very much, which I think is interesting. I just think it's just not really a very good film, and there isn't perhaps very much in there that people got to grips with. Yeah, I'm sure there is, though. I'm sure that we can find it if we look. But anyway, the overall point is that if Kubrick did things in his films or did his films in a certain way that was confounding, and that, you know, people who argue for Kubrick as this great artist will say that he's doing it because he's experimenting and he's departing from dramatic form and he's confounding audience expectation. And yeah, I will give it that. But they don't really talk about what to me is more interesting, like, but the acting is really bad, the dialogue is really bad, he cast Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. I mean, these are interesting questions to me. Like, why would this great genius do things that seem to be just really sketchy as far as creating art go? And in the past, I was just like, well, he's crap, he's overrated, he's conned everyone. And now I see, okay, that was my own kind of position I had to hold on to, and I'm letting go of it and looking for something deeper. Okay? And this is what I've come up with, that it was part of the generation of cognitive dissonance at a very high level, really, because how do you square that? I mean, how do you square that this great genius makes these artistic decisions which really just seem kind of unfathomable?
I have ideas, but I'm sure everyone's biting their tongue. I want you to jump to your ninth point here. You say this idea of they became less and less important to Kubrick as it says, Kubrick films are not films, but means for experimenting on audiences. They are disguised to look like movies to make it past audiences' defenses. The disguise became less and less important to Kubrick as the experiment progressed. And is this kind of this idea that you think Eyes Wide Shut is blatantly bad? Like that the films got worse?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I used to think that Kubrick was just becoming more and more isolated and cut off from human, you know, vocal patterns and human behavior. And so his movies just seemed to be kind of more and more dissociated or something. And there may be something in that. I mean, if he was, I think it's tricky to try and psychoanalyze somebody that you've never met, and I've had a habit of doing it in the past, so I don't want to do it too much this time with Kubrick. But if he was as in deep as it seems clear to all of us here he was, it would be deranging. It would be very hard to maintain the ground of just what's real and what's unreal, what's right, what's wrong. And filmmaking for him clearly was a way to navigate that labyrinth that he himself was lost in, is my feeling. But I think, yeah, I think Kubrick was operating at a very high social, political, even you could say spiritual level, not necessarily high in a sense of better or anything, but just dealing with some very extreme realities. And so making films for him, it may well have been, and this just occurred to me yesterday, talking to my wife, it may well have been that the film, the product of the film itself, was secondary to the process of making it that he was involved in. And so with Eyes Wide Shut, and slightly coming off topic, I mean, this is another angle to look at this, but hopefully it's congruent with the first point that he was making films is to experiment on society. But there may have also been that he was maneuvering, like a chess player, his own, the pieces of his own life, and that when he was making films, that it's a political arena that you're in. If you're a Hollywood filmmaker, you're among the elite, and you're constantly negotiating for power. And with Eyes Wide Shut, I was listening to Jay Widener, and it occurred to me that, I mean, he mentioned this, that and I just heard about this, that Vivian Kubrick was joined Scientology sometime around Eyes Wide Shut. I haven't ascertained if it was before or during, but and that may have had something to do with why Tom Cruise was in Eyes Wide Shut. It may be that Scientology, because they had something on his daughter, they actually pressured Kubrick into casting Tom Cruise. Or it could
seem like his ego too. He's such an egomaniac. It's kind of ideal, always taking out his id everywhere he goes, you know, and being like, "I'm a doctor." It's like, I felt like that's my favorite Tom Cruise role I've ever seen him in. That and Magnolia, just because, for the same reason that he plays this, you know, egomaniac douchebag. Breakdown, you know.
True, but in Magnolia, it worked. You really felt like, wow, that's Tom Cruise is actually acting now, because he's showing something real of himself, whereas I didn't get that with Eyes Wide Shut. I got the feeling that if Kubrick had cast Tom Cruise actually for aesthetic reasons, it was to show how shallow and dissociated Americans are, or something like that. Like, he wanted this kind of lifeless puppet at the center of his movie, or they're all like that.
Sure. I'm glad every character's an archetype in that regard, right?
Sorry, I didn't.
So like every character is kind of an archetype, and that he is kind of meant to fulfill a certain type of archetype.
I didn't feel that. I mean, I did. There is a very interesting subtext in Eyes Wide Shut, and Zizek certainly nailed it, or he got something really rich out of that. So I'll allow that. But to me, if the subtext doesn't mesh with the text, I'm kind of indifferent. Like, if until now, because now I see where Kubrick seems to create, the text is the narrative, right? And then the subtext is the themes, and they're supposed to weave together and be inseparable and be organically one whole. That's art, right? That's how we recognize a work of art. Whereas Kubrick, he seems to have deliberately separated them. So you've got the narrative, which is often just kind of, you can say it's dreamlike if you want, or hyperreal, but I would say it's just kind of clunky and unconvincing.
Well, you know, the source of Eyes Wide Shut is Dream Story, which is all meant to be a dream in the first place.
Sure. Yeah, I know that. But still, he's not, you know, you can create a dreamlike reality, and it feels like a dreamlike reality, and you don't have to rationalize it afterwards and say, oh, the film was so unconvincing, or the actors were this, that, and the other, because it's a dream. You just surrendered to it. And Kubrick didn't do that. Whether he couldn't do it, because artistically he didn't have the chops, or I would say perhaps more likely, he wasn't trying to do that. He wasn't actually trying to get us to suspend disbelief. I mean, this is the thing about movie making, right? Is that the contract, the unwritten contract between the filmmaker and the audience is to suspend disbelief. The filmmaker needs the audience to suspend disbelief, and the audience needs the filmmaker to persuade them to suspend disbelief. Well, Kubrick didn't do that. He didn't go along with that. Like, he broke the contract, I think.
But I guess the question here is, where is that contract written? Because when I go to an art gallery and I look at a painting on a wall, I'm not
trying to be convinced that I'm looking through a window onto a wintry meadow or some shit. I'm looking at a painting, right? And I'm not so there's no contract there that I'm looking at the painting and I'm expecting them to make it real for me. I'm expecting them to give me an aesthetic, an experience of this, of that. And we can go into the you know, idea of artistry here, but I'm just sort of making a point. I don't think I agree with you that we've at some point accepted that as an unwritten contract, but I don't know if that's necessarily valid. I just saw last week, I saw the movie Birdman, which was fucking incredible, but I left the movie quickly replaying everything in my mind going, that movie was actually potentially terrible. The dialogue was horrendous. I mean, really some of the worst dialogue I've ever experienced in my life. But the acting was so superb and the tone of the movie was so superb that it was okay. It was like, not even that, just that it was okay. It made them more archetypes, if you will. Like it elevated them from cliche to archetype. It was, this is just my experience, but it was like, I realized how one piece out of place that movie would have been garbage so quickly. It would just be like the dialogue was so clunky and cliche. But as I said, it was a perfect, in my experience, the perfect tone was struck that in that moment, I'm watching archetypes, not cliches. And it's such a, you know, it takes, I think, a really strong skill to bring it across one side or the other of that fine line. And I don't, and again, I'm not trying to convince you to see Kubrick as doing something similar. I just, that was my experience. The closest thing, and it doesn't have to be necessarily a superb artistry, because I could say both Birdman is a commentary on film itself. And Kubrick famously is a lot of commentary on film. If the monolith is supposed to be the movie screen, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of, I think, commentary on, yes, look at me, look at the art that I'm making, and blending real world and the, it's almost like performance art, right? Where you mentioned The Shining and his daughter, the only really behind the scenes footage that was allowed is on The Shining. There's a 30-minute quasi-documentary that his daughter filmed of behind the scenes of The Shining. And who shows up but the guy from Lolita, right? The actor who plays the pedophile on Lolita shows up on the set of The Shining, and that's in this documentary. And
which then you actor have, is that? Sorry.
It's something Mason.
James Mason.
James Mason shows up on the set. So here you, and he's like playing with Kubrick's daughters or something. Now you have the idea of in The Shining, like these. He has the Playgirl magazine that talks about parents sleeping with their children. We have the incestual angle and the pedophile angle throughout The Shining. So then when you have James Mason show up on the set, it becomes – it's another – it's like a big fucking clue in one respect, but it's also a bending of fiction and reality. As you say, he's trying to blur those lines between fiction and reality. Is it so that we can dissociate or so we can wake up from the dissociation? And just again, really, I just say this as a devil's advocate here, because I'm not convinced one way or the other about Kubrick's intentions. I can't possibly speculate. But there is a Japanese animator, amazing director, Hayao Miyazaki, right? He does Spirited Away and Totoro and all these really, really wonderful films. He talks about this idea that he's an environmentalist, he loves the outdoors, and he keeps making these films. His intention is to make these films that show children playing in this like fantasy world. And he's hoping to encourage kids to go out and explore and play real life. And he said he kept realizing was that he's kind of doing the opposite. By making a great film, the kids are staying inside and watching more films. instead of going out and playing. So he was like, I'm trying really hard to encourage them to go out, and what are they doing is it's actually the opposite is happening.
Right.
You know, take that as you will, but what if he's trying to get almost like a Jodorowsky, you know, zoom back camera type idea. Kubrick is saying, listen, this isn't real. Take a look, step outside the screen. But we're seeing it as being pulled into the screen. And I could, again, really fine line.
Mm. Yeah, well, I agree. And I agree also that there's no point in trying to figure out Kubrick's intentions. So, I mean, in the end, we can only observe the results in our own laboratory, right? We can't try and remote view anyone else's laboratory and figure out. So the only way, I mean, the best and perhaps the only way to figure out the effects of Kubrick's films is by self-examination, right? So for me, there was a major realization with The Shining, which was the, like, because for me, and this is what my book Seen and Not Seen is largely about, for me, the strongest ideology I've had in life, because I've never been a political person or a religious person, has been about movies. Like, what's a good movie and what's a bad movie? That's an ideology for me. I even wrote once that if morality is said to be nothing more than a matter of taste, we have to then allow that taste is nothing less than a question of morality. So that kind of sums up how aesthetics or art, you know, what is art, is an ideological question for me. And so for me to actually allow myself to let go of the belief and the perception that The Shining was a bad movie and embrace it as something other than that, as a great stroke bad movie, as and whatever, I mean, just an anomaly. And that was a big shift for me. And so I had to allow, I mean, I think it's been part of a larger shift of letting go of, letting go of assumptions and beliefs and kind of structural definitions within myself, like an inner letting go, potentially, anyway. So because of that, I've had to allow, okay, what Kubrick is doing is potentially beneficent. You know, I have had a positive experience, psychologically kind of liberating experience through Kubrick's work. Fantastic. Wow. That totally turns my whole world around in itself again, you know, hopefully, so it's not back where it was to begin with. You know, hopefully it's still spinning into new perceptions. And so for me, the closest I can get to some sort of positing, some sort of theory or observation about this is that a key to allowing for a liberating effect of Kubrick's films involves letting go of the idea that Kubrick is a great artist, that what he's doing is great art. And that's kind of a paradox, because then if something great happens as a result of that, then you're back to thinking, oh my God, he is great. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't really matter to me in the end, or it needn't matter, like what people think of Kubrick and whether he was a great artist, whether he wasn't. This is such a, like David earlier was saying that it was irrelevant to him, but I don't grok that, because I feel that we've grown up in a culture where the desire to be great is just so embedded into all of us. And
right, but who sets the standard for what entails greatness, and what is the value of film in the first place? What is the purpose of film in the first place? I think a lot of what we're like, I mean, Siskel and Ebert gave 2001 two thumbs down, and then mm-hmm. put it in like what, the top three best movies of all times 20 years later. Like, mm-hmm. what is our, like, there's kind of this consensus view about what makes something have value. And I mean, I look at especially his last films, and I see them all kind of, I don't know if you're familiar with like Colin Wilson's The Outsider, where he analyzes the archetype of the outsider as an artist, and looks at like Van Gogh and looks at Hermann Hesse and kind of like takes their work and works them into a composite and says, what is their overarching point? But like, I take the principle presented by Colin Wilson in The Outsider and I apply it to Kubrick's last films, and I see them all kind of like dancing around the same psychological conundrum or point, like trying to like allow for some reflection. And there's a definite theme. You look at, Full Metal Jacket, and you see Private Pyle's whole breakdown and what that means in terms of a psyche. Like when I hear the Jill Sergeant say, what are you guys doing in my head? I take it literally as just that, or that it's Kubrick himself saying, what are you guys doing in my head? You know, I see like all the principles that are expressed in psychoanalysis of repression and as a result, sublimation, and how violence stems from those repressions and the shadow. And you see that these are explicitly expressed points, like in that film when he's like, what's with the, you know, the pin that's, the peace sign and then the born to kill. And he's like, I'm talking about the Jungian thing, sir. And you look at the implications of that, the fact that you can't see the enemy, quote unquote, you know, and we have seen the enemy and it is us being stated in the film, this kind of thing. And then you look at The Shining and you see that he's not, that from a Reichian standpoint, he's not getting his basic needs met, and he's acting out of violence of just due to that repression, you know. And then you look at Eyes Wide Shut, and you see the same principle at play of Tom Cruise wandering around the neighborhood in this kind of like frustration because he can't take his wife revealing to him how, you know, easily everything that they've built together could just be. You know, it's like, but that's like a psychoanalytical session. That's not the same kind of art form anymore, because that's not what most film sets out to do, is to psychoanalyze the viewer and kind of encourage them to psychoanalyze themselves in that way with very specific points, you know, and then drilling those same points home again and again and again. So it seems like what determines the value of a piece of art, you know, of where are you coming from? What is the purpose? Is it a distraction? Like, if you're looking for the best distraction, then Kubrick's not the place to look. If you're, you know what I'm saying?
So for you, would you say Kubrick is like a teacher?
Yeah, in a sense, but I would say more of like a reflection than somebody who's actually teaching you, like trying to make as clear of a mirror as possible. It's paradoxical though, because what needs to be pointed out is all the kinks in the character armor, you know, or what the, like, I couldn't agree more with your ninth point, that Kubrick films are not films, but means for experimenting on audiences. They are disguised to look like movies to make it past audiences' defenses. I see that as getting past their character armor. I couldn't actually agree more.
Yeah, because there's something there, like I like this idea of we don't have to place anyone on a pedestal. You know, there was an old TV show, MythBusters, Penn and Teller Bullshit, one of those type things. And they did a where they go into a restaurant and they take a can of cat food and like these garbage ingredients. And they bring it into this really fine dining restaurant, and they basically decorate it really nice on the plate, and they have the waiter tell the people, oh, you're going to get this great meal, and oh my God, it has this ingredient, and this. And people eating it, and they're like, oh, this is fantastic. Like, they're having these people on camera go, oh, yes, this is great. And then there's like one guy in the restaurant who's like, what is this garbage? This is bullshit. What the fuck is this? Mm. But they were able to convince people just by saying it was great that even if they didn't like it, they had to say that it was great because they're expected to say that it's great. So I totally get that point. But there's David's idea, like, again, it's a reflection. When we say a science doesn't have to be quote unquote nefarious, and I don't even have to, I think it does remove itself from art. Like, we have famous painters, right, and architects who they found what they called the golden proportion, right? And they start to work this into their paintings. Oh, an ideal painting has this proportion here and this here, and the ideal building will have this structure to it. And at that point, it's a science, not an art, or it's a scientific art, or wherever you want to draw those lines. I could very, very easily, yeah, see that ninth point as, or even that first point, the idea of becoming a scientist, or where does that line cross?
Yeah, well, I have to say, it's so very captivating. But to David's point about the character armor, this continuation of Alan as well, I would really question that, because I don't. My sense of Kubrick is that he was somebody who didn't let down his character armor, and that his films demonstrate that time and time again. They're even about that in a certain sense. And that, again, the medium is the message. So if you're going to somebody for therapy, let's say, it doesn't matter how much knowledge they have and how much expertise, they can only, this is my view, they can only take you as far as they are themselves, to the extent that they have processed their own internal trauma, their own neuroses, and cleared the conditioning that they've been, imprisoned by. Only to that extent can they lead somebody else to a similar kind of state of.
Oh, I wasn't trying to suggest that he's a therapist.
No, I know, but you were saying that the films,
a mirror up of society and culture at large, and what the actual dynamics are that allow us to continue to live the way that we're living and do what we're doing, and just to be that reflection, not necessarily to liberate or to drive us in deeper. Though that's open to debate. That's just my feeling around it. But,
Yeah, and it's really confounding. Sorry to interrupt, but because you can really teach by example, and like I've had so many experiences now, or several anyway, with spiritual teachers where I've ended up feeling like I'd been conned, which is how I feel with Kubrick to an extent. But the recognition of having been conned was actually more liberating than the experience of actually trusting and following this person, and in the sense that the two went together, like the one just naturally and organically led to the other. So I think that Kubrick could be making films for the worst reasons. They could be harmful. I think that Clockwork Orange certainly is, and so I think there's that element in his films that potentially harmful or corrupting, to use a very loaded word. But even not just despite that, but even to an extent because of that, there is a really valid and valuable lesson in that. And so I bring specifically to what Alan was talking about with the this consensus, is where you go with the herd. There's this pressure just to agree and say the food is good because everyone else is saying that. If Kubrick was doing that, and I do believe he was, that many people just convince themselves that they're seeing a great film because they're aware of that is the consensus view, then for whatever his reasons, that is an incredibly valuable lesson to see that. Back to Dave's point, I think that, who defines what is art? Who defines what has value? And the answer is you do, alone. You cannot refer to any other system and any other consensus to decide what has value for you. You can, but you won't ever actually discover the thing of true value, which is that part of you that can discern what has value.
Totally. Couldn't agree more.
And so that's a fantastic thing, the service that Kubrick's providing, and whether he's doing it despite himself or not is kind of irrelevant in a sense. I mean, it's interesting, obviously, but it doesn't change the opportunity, doesn't reduce the opportunity of the work, even if he was, working for the government and part of a satanic pedophile elite and all the other things we can speculate about.
can Mark join in?
Yeah, I think that's Mark's cue, yeah.
So,
everybody's talking up a storm. act like they don't notice it. But here it is and here it comes. Here comes the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon. Here comes the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon. Oh yeah. Impulse always quickens when it's my head around me. Yes, it does. And here it comes. Here comes the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon. Here comes the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon. Here comes the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon. Oh yeah. Gift I see that's moving up there into the night. Oh, dark, the mirror in the sky reflects a soft light. Looks like a little brother to the sun. Oh, mother to the stars at night, and he. Here comes the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon. Here comes the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon. Oh yeah. Breath is always taken when it's new. Enhance upon the clouds around it. Yes, it is, and here it comes. Here comes the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon. Here comes the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon. Here comes the moon.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from the SyncBook Radio, a production of thesyncbook.com. If you enjoy this show, there's so much more content waiting for you. For more information about our work, such as books, videos, or events, begin to explore thesyncbook.com. And for the latest regarding SyncBook Radio, keep your dial tuned to thesyncbook.com/radio. Currently, we produce 5 weekly shows, 2 of which we are excited to introduce: Astro Music by Ezra Sansers Bell on Mondays, and Pentimental by John and Thomas McGuire on Fridays. Our other weekly shows include 42 Minutes on Tuesdays, the Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour on Wednesdays, and Always Record on Thursdays. We also produce the quarterly audio magazine Synchronize, our long-form thematic sync journalism undertaking, as well as our newest weekly video blast, Sync Quick News, giving you the week in sync in 5 minutes or less. Want to be a part of the SyncBook Radio? Become a donor. Please visit thesyncbook.com/donate, or better yet, become a member of SyncBook Plus. Details soon to follow. Do stay tuned, and thank you once again for all of your support.